From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix. This is Here and Now, and we're beginning our final week of 2021 with a big spike in COVID-19 cases driven by the Omicron variant. The CDC reported on Friday that the seven-day national average of new cases was up 65% over the previous 2 weeks. And around the country, we're seeing governments introduce more mask mandates. Some gyms and restaurants are closing temporarily. Airlines are canceling hundreds of flights each day as their crews test positive. Chief White House Medical Advisor Dr. Anthony Fauci told NPR this morning that he's hopeful the current spike will come down soon, but he also urged people not to be complacent.
This is an extraordinarily efficient virus in spreading from person to person. It is just something like we've never seen before. The cases in any place you go, when the virus gets in there, it goes way up. So for those who have not had a severe impact yet, please continue to be prudent about wearing masks. And if you're not vaccinated, get vaccinated. And if you're vaccinated, please go get boosted.
We'll have the latest on the surge elsewhere in today's show, but first let's focus on something else that millions of Americans are thinking about in the final days of this year, the state of their finances. The new year will usher in tax season along with student loan repayments and tax complications for people whose lives have been in flux this year. Let's get some advice from Jill Schlesinger. She's a CBS News business analyst and host of Jill on Money. Jill, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me. Happy New Year almost.
Happy New Year almost to you. And speaking of that, what is the number one thing that people need to know about getting their finances in shape as that year does come to a close?
You know, with just a few days, it's not like you're going to make a huge impact. But I will say that it's nice to know where you stand before the calendar turns over to the next year. And you always think about that when it comes to taxes, because taxes always kind of flummox people. You pay them in April, but it's for the year before, and there are things you can do before the end of the year, but maybe not so much at this point. What I really want to recommend that everybody does do is head over to the IRS website, which I'm sure you all have bookmarked. It's irs.gov, and they've got this nifty withholding estimator. And some of the things that the IRS does drives people crazy. This happens to be a very good one. It basically says how much money you've had set aside to pay your tax bill in April. Now, obviously, if you had done this in the middle of November when your certified financial planner friends told you to do this, you'd have time to make a real difference. Now I'm asking you to do that just to know what you need to think about. Because if you've under-withheld, maybe if you have one last pay stub, you could potentially get a change. But what you really want to know is if I owe taxes, I better know that going in because I want to start saving up some money in advance of that to pay the bill come April.
And we'll link people to that website at hereandnow.org as well. So, Jill, also, let's just clarify this. There's no tax filing extension on the radar this year, is there?
I think the only extension that has actually been announced is for those tornado victims in, you know, places like Kentucky. But for the vast majority of Americans who have had these little extensions because of COVID, we're looking at April 15th for most people. And, you know, I think that that's fine. Remember, when we think about taxes, and I know we'll talk about this more next year, but you know, most people are due refunds. A startling number of people get refunds when it comes to tax time. And, you know, I think it's always kind of a funny thing that people say, like, well, I'm waiting till April 15th to file. Well, if I'm due money from Uncle Sam, I want to file as soon as tax filing season opens, which is usually the end of January.
Yeah. There are a lot of us out there who are working remotely. And I know that last year I really dreaded doing my taxes because I moved out of state, but I kept working at the same job. So remind people what they might need to keep in mind if they're in that situation this year.
Yeah, this is such a tax headache. And you're right. So the first thing that you want to recognize is that when you live, you might live even in the same state, but county to county, municipality to municipality, it could be different in terms of taxes. So if you've stayed in the same place, great. If you're the kind of person who said, well, I went and camped out at my parents' house in another county or state, you start tallying up how much time you spent in each location. Now, I'm sure that many of you are going to sort of say, well, I can't do that, but you can kind of give a guesstimate. Don't go crazy. Mm-hmm. And then what you want to do is you want to check out what is the tax situation in each jurisdiction. And in some cases, you might be pleasantly surprised. Hey, I lived with my folks in a place where taxes were way lower. So it's worth doing this annoying task of counting days because you might have a lower tax bill.
A lot of people are still moving across the country, too, as a result of all the flux from the pandemic. And so I think that still applies to a bunch of people. Now, Jill, let's talk about contributions to retirement accounts. It's the end of the year. And for those who have them, what do you recommend? What should we think about?
First of all, you know, most of the workers out there have a workplace retirement plan. That can be a 401k, could be a 403b. Maybe you work for a municipality, it's a 457 plan. And if that's the case, and we are talking, it's, you know, again, days before the end of the year, if you have the chance to maybe bump up your contribution level for one last pay period and sock some money away, that's fantastic. For everyone else, usually if you're using an IRA or a Roth IRA, it's a great idea to think about funding that for the year, but you have until your tax filing deadline. One thing that is somewhat unique, people moved around, as you said, they were job hopping, and you've heard about the Great Resignation. Mm-hmm. For some people, this was a year where you earned less income, maybe you had a gap in your earning. For those kinds of folks, you may want to look at an existing traditional retirement account, a traditional IRA. You may want to convert that into a Roth IRA. And the beauty of that is you convert the amount of money that has been not taxed yet. You move it into a Roth IRA. And the one downside is you've got to pay the tax due. But if you're in the 12% tax bracket this year, but you know that next year you're going up to 22 or 24, you may want to pay the tax that's due when it's only 12%. So I think that's a really good idea if you have lower income this year than you think you'll have in the future.
Okay. Jill, on the issue of savings, it can be tough to do this time of year. Even for the people who got extra child tax credits or extra stimulus money this year, it's tough to save during the holidays especially. Give us some ideas that might motivate people to just like stash a few extra bucks away if they can spare it.
Well, I mean, one great incentive is that sometimes weird stuff happens. You can replace stuff with whatever word you want to replace it with. And I think we've just learned that lesson. I mean, the past 2 years is kind of the masterclass in holy smokes, weird things can happen. And having savings can be a real lifeboat when weird things happen. I don't know what's going to happen next, but I do think the people who had a little bit extra savings in their accounts amid COVID, as people were furloughed, as people were sent home, before stimulus checks were cut, they were really happy they had those. So I think you don't need a ton of motivation for that. I want to just be sure that everyone understands that while we have pent-up demand, we have a lot of excitement about maybe spending on something for fun in the holidays and this, that, and the other thing, I think that we also learned that we know what's important. We had this this period of time of almost 2 years where you really understand what is an absolute need in your life. Mm. And sometimes the just sort of reminding yourself, I don't think you should go back into your fear-based, you know, cowering in the corner, I'm worried about disease. But what I do think is valuable is to say, hey, you know what? I did find out that I don't need as much stuff and I don't need to do as many things as I thought I did. That's how Americans saved more than $2.4 trillion amid COVID. We didn't have a lot to spend on. And I'm not sure that we really need to forget that period so quickly. I think having a little bit of that in our lives today makes us less consumptive and allows us to take a little bit more control of our own financial lives.
I hear that. I really do. Jill, it's the end of the year. We always have this conversation at the end of the year with you. Wouldn't it be better if we, I don't know, had it in January or started thinking about all this stuff before December 31st?
Well, I want you to know this. I have this conversation every single day because I have a podcast, and this is just what it is funny, that my podcast is a daily podcast. You guys do a daily show, but many people are surprised. They say, well, how could you have a podcast 7 days a week? And I said, you would be surprised how many people have anxiety and questions about their own financial lives. And what I have found is that amid COVID, when people were home and they had this opportunity to really look within, this was one of the areas that they really wanted to tackle and really help themselves. And so I will tell you that every single day I have this conversation. So if anyone listening wants a little bit of love, come to JillOnMoney.com and ask me your question.
Yes, that's the podcast, and you're also a business analyst at CBS News, so you've got your hands full. We appreciate you taking the time to talk money with us. We really do. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, and thank you so much. You have a wonderful listening audience, and I'm very grateful to be on your airwaves every week.
We're grateful to have you, too. Thanks, Jill. Fans of country singer Sturgill Simpson will be eager to find out if the musician will be back on stage in 2022. That's because back in September, Simpson announced that he'd suffered a vocal cord hemorrhage. The injury forced him to cancel the remainder of his 2021 concert dates. And as he told his fans on social media, it'll be a long, hot minute before he gets back to singing again. And that's a shame, because 2021 was a big year for Sturgill Simpson. In August, he released his latest album, The Ballad of Dude and Juanita. This song is Old Dude Part 1.
Left the varnish off his words, feeding no beast nor man. Didn't want to end up in his debt, because it damn sure get paid. He was harder than the nails hammered Jesus' hands. He was the one they called Dude. Son of a mountain miner and a Shawnee man.
The Ballad of Dude and Juanita is up for a Grammy for Best Country Album. His Cuttin' Grass Volume 1 Butcher Shop Sessions was also nominated for Best Bluegrass Album. And he appears on the John Prine tribute album Broken Hearts and Dirty Windows Volume 2, which came out in October. Simpson performed one of Prine's most famous songs, Paradise, for that album.
Daddy wants to take me back to Muhlenberg County, down by the Green River, where paradise lay. I'm sorry, my son, but too late in asking, Mr. Peabody's coal train is hauled away.
We spoke with Sturgill Simpson about John Prine back in June. Our original studio quality recording for the interview failed, which is why you're about to hear Sturgill Simpson on a phone line. But once he gets telling stories about his old friend John Prine, we don't think you're going to mind. Sturgill Simpson, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, John Prine wrote Paradise 50 years ago for his father, who was from Paradise, Kentucky. It's been covered dozens and dozens of times. What draws you to it?
I mean, it's one of those songs you've known your entire life, probably before you were too young to even know you knew it. We were in the studio recording Volume 1, Cuttin' Grass. So, we had the band there. I think that was the first take, I think, is the one you just played. Because nobody had to learn it, if you know what I mean. At that point, it was still fresh. I haven't really grasped that he's gone, just because there was no goodbye at all for anyone, especially his family members.
Well, for most of us, John Prine was like this legendary songwriter, but for you, he was that, but he was also your friend, right? I mean, what did he mean to you personally and as a musician?
Well, one, you have to get past the legend, because he was this unnervingly down-to-earth, extremely humble person. But for me, the real enlightening perspective came from hearing him talk about, his earlier life.
I always figured my music come from somewhere between here and Kentucky. We used to go down there as often as we could until the town got tore down by Mr. Peabody.
His coal train is hauled it away. Well, sometimes we travel right down the Green River to the abandoned old prison down by Avery Hill.
where the air smelled like snakes, and we'd shoot with our pistols. But empty pop bottles was all we would kill. And Daddy, won't you take me back to Muhlenberg County, down by the Green River, where paradise lay.
You know, everybody says don't meet your heroes. I would say John Prine was definitely an exception to that rule.
Yeah. So what was it like when you met him? Because you must have been starstruck.
The first time I met him, I was sitting in the studio at the butcher shop, probably actually late 2015, and I took a break, you know, hit the space bar and I turned around, and he was just sitting there. And I'll never forget it because he was wearing plaid pants and like a periwinkle blue linen cotton sport coat. He was just sort of sitting there listening, and he's just like, I'm hungry, let's go get some lunch. And then he knew I just had a couple kids, so my house was full of energy and noise, and he had a little office there in the studio. We called it an office, but there's nothing in there but a jukebox and a pool table. And he said, you know, he had a set of keys made, and said anytime he knew a place. So we shared that room for the better part of 3 years, but we were never in the room at the same time. And all that time, I could see signs he'd been there, and likewise, and he'd usually like flip my drums upside down or move them around or something.
Really?
He's like every time it was always some little sign. But yeah, he, you know, when I got the news that he went into the hospital, I just sort of was standing outside and just kind of, accepted the fact that I probably was never going to see him again.
I'm sorry that you lost your friend and your hero. He was a hero to a lot of us. You're also from Kentucky and from a family of coal miners. I just wonder, you know, what that legacy, how that's inspired your own music and the way you think about things.
Immensely, especially on that topic. That song definitely connected with me at a very young age. I've written a couple songs about it.
I'll be one of the first in a long, long line not to go down from old Black Lung. Yeah, my death will be slower than the rest of my kind, and my life will be sadder than the songs they all sung. Well, now, old King Cole, what are we gonna do when the mountains are gone and so are you?
My mother's father and her brother, all my grandfathers, great-grandfathers were coal miners, and so from outside looking in, there's the devastation and the lack of sustainability in terms of worshiping little black lumps of rock for energy. But when you live in those communities, or more importantly, I'll say, for instance, my grandfather had a seventh grade education, but because he worked, you know, as a foreman, you know, with a seventh grade education, was making $90,000 to $110,000 a year, and that provided for our family in a way that wouldn't have been possible otherwise. And then now that those industries have sort of dried up and left, taking all the money with them and left the regional devastation, you know, those opportunities aren't there anymore, and there's none being brought in. So I guess for me, the lack of understanding, I guess, from outsiders, they want to know why the region is so hell-bent on the return of those jobs, is because it was the one thing that ever really brought sustainable income and outside of that opportunity, in a lot of ways, hope in Appalachia.
Yeah. Let's hear some more of your music. You came out with two albums late last year, Cutting Grass, Volume 1 and 2. This one is called Hobo Cartoon.
Wish I was riding the steam train right out of the pages of town, down through the old roaring 20s, for the fall of 1929. Back in the heyday railroad, before airplanes fluttered and flew, color me in like a cartoon hobo, doing what bums used to do.
You wrote that song with Merle Haggard, but he died in 2016. You got to explain how that song came about.
That song, actually, Merle wrote the lyrics while he was in the hospital bed, probably knowing he was at the end of his life, and he was still writing songs. He was just laying there, and he sent me that song via text message, and it was from one railroader to another. And I was like, God, what am I going to do with this, you know? And then when this record came up, you know, I was like, well, now or never, this is sort of these are the records that this song belongs on.
What was it like for you to get a song texted to you from Merle Haggard on his deathbed? I mean, how did you feel about that? It's kind of an honor, isn't it?
It's an immense honor. But yeah, man, mostly I just miss these guys. It's tough. I feel like I've lost my grandfather 5 times, especially when you don't really get to say all the things you wish you had, or you were always too nervous to, or you didn't want to bother him when you're in front of him. You just, you know, you don't want to be that guy. So you just, a lot of times we just sit there and not saying anything. And then now I just wish, you know, I had one good opportunity to embarrass myself.
What would you say to him?
A bunch of stuff I'm not going to say on NPR. But I don't know, man. I just probably just hug him and tell him thanks. And I love him. And I don't know. Stop smoking. Yeah. What a year. Jesus.
It's been rough. It's been rough. Sturgill Simpson, Grammy Award-winning singer and songwriter. Thank you so much for speaking with us. It's been a pleasure.
Appreciate it.
Oh my God, it's so beautiful. Everything is part of me.
That was our conversation with Sturgill Simpson from last year.
It's made of wool, but if you close your eyes, it becomes.
As the Omicron variant races across the country, let's get the latest with Dr. Peter Hotez. He's the co-director of the Center for Vaccine Development at Texas Children's Hospital. He's on a Skype line. Doctor, welcome.
Hey, it's good to hear from you.
Good to have you. So as the number of new cases in some parts of the country is now surpassing levels higher than it's been at any point in this pandemic, how would you describe how quickly the virus is spreading?
Yeah, it was pretty impressive. You know, usually we've had about 4 to 6 weeks when we've had a big wave in the UK before it comes here to the US, and it's just really come up on us pretty suddenly, and it's so transmissible, and the slope is just completely vertical. So that's really impressive. And even though there's some preliminary evidence that the Omicron variant is not as severe as the other lineages, it's severe enough. And now we're starting to see hospitalizations, especially among the unvaccinated or partially unvaccinated, start to rise, particularly in places like Washington, D.C., New York, and as I say, going west to Chicago. So overwhelmingly in the northeastern part of the country, going towards the beginning part of the Midwest.
How much worse do you think it might get before this wave peaks?
Well, you know, each variant has its unique set of circumstances or its unique little shop of horrors. And I think in the case of Omicron, it's that it's severe enough, and we're getting so many healthcare workers and healthcare providers infected. So it's knocking out a segment of the workforce, not that they're sick enough to go into the hospital, but sick enough to be at home and therefore not being able to take care of patients. And we've seen in the past when there's that stress on the healthcare system, on the ICUs, that's when mortality goes up. So for those reasons, I'm concerned. Also, the fact that we've got now two of our monoclonal antibodies not working against this Omicron variant, leaving the one from GSK available, but that's available in limited quantities. And of course, if you're going to give that or remdesivir, which is our only other modality, what do? Because we don't have enough testing in place. So people have to know that they're positive before they're eligible for those treatments. So all of that combined together will create a very serious situation for us here in the next few weeks.
You're a pediatrician, and we see that in New York City, pediatric hospitalizations are up 395% from just a few weeks ago. What are you seeing where you are in terms of kids getting sick with Omicron? And is that something we should be increasingly aware of?
Well, it's not as bad down here yet as it is up in the Northeast. It'll get there. But we had some experience with it with our Delta wave. So we saw a lot of Delta-based pediatric hospital admissions here in the southern states and here in Texas. And I think we'll definitely the same in with Omicron in the north and eventually down here, based on what we saw in South Africa, a lot of pediatric hospitalizations. And I would say it's probably a similar basis as Delta, not so much that this virus is selectively targeting the kids, it's just that it creates a firestorm, or as my friend Mike Osterholm likes to call it, a viral blizzard. And with all those people getting infected, kids are getting swept up in it as well.
Well, and the kids, of course, they can't get boosted yet at this point for the most part because they probably just got their shots and they're too young. Dr. Peter Hotez, co-director of the Center for Vaccine Development at Texas Children's Hospital. Thank you so much, as always, for your time.
Thanks. All the best.
Last winter, powerful storms and record cold temperatures in Texas knocked out much of the state's power grid. Millions were without electricity for days. The storm caused close to $200 billion in damage, and energy officials say the grid is still vulnerable. Scientists are also warning that as the climate changes, we can expect more frequent and powerful storms to disrupt the nation's electric grid. But two environmental justice communities in the Boston area are preparing for the worst and planning for a more resilient energy future. They're building the nation's first cloud-based microgrids. From member station WBUR, Bruce Gellerman reports.
The ringtone at Chelsea's Emergency Response Center is surprisingly soothing.
911, this line is recorded. Where's your emergency?
Dispatcher Sheila Lacey says the 911 center gets about 100 calls a day.
Nobody considers us to be first responders, but we are the first. We're the first people they talk to, sometimes the last. We're very critical to the city.
But what happens to 911 emergency when it has an emergency?
We had a major power outage in the city. Lost complete power to everything. Yeah.
Chelsea 911 dispatch supervisor Paul Koulian has been on the job nearly four decades, but he still recalls June 1st, 2000.
The whole city was shut down. Traffic lights, street lights. We were in here operating with portable radios and flashlights.
Soon after, Chelsea bought a diesel generator to keep essential services up and running during a blackout. The generator is controlled from a locked room in the basement of City Hall. Public Works Commissioner Fidel Maltese opens the door.
What you see here is our main switch gear. This gear has also reached enough life. It's about 20 years old. So this is going to get replaced. And the switch gear then becomes fully electronic and doesn't require any human interaction to operate. It's all software operated.
The new software will control a new emergency backup system. Chelsea is pioneering a virtual microgrid. City buildings will be connected in the cloud rather than with wires. Each building will be equipped with generators powered by biodiesel or renewable natural gas. On the rooftops, solar panels that charge lithium batteries for storage. In the future, if the electric grid goes down, Fidel Moltes says the cloud-based microgrid will kick in.
We are a coastal community. When a climate crisis hits Chelsea, City Hall is going to have its lights on.
So will Chelsea's police headquarters and 911 dispatch. They're phase one of the microgrid, which the city plans to have online in a year or two. Later, Moltes hopes to add local hospitals and low-income housing.
We have over 20% of our residents that live below the poverty line. We know that in a climate disasters, these are the residents that are going to be impacted. So we are trying to be as proactive as possible to ensure the microgrid really is centered on helping those that are most vulnerable.
Chelsea is the only municipality in Massachusetts where every neighborhood is designated an environmental justice population. It's the smallest city in the state, but carries an outsized environmental burden. All of Logan Airport's jet fuel is stored here, so is most of the state's road salt and the region's heating fuel. The Green Justice Coalition, nine community organizations, champion the microgrid project. The technology was designed by David Dayton, a retired engineer and entrepreneur who founded Resilient Urban Neighborhoods.
Energy is a human right. We want to create what I call fossil-free zones around low-income communities.
Dayton calls cloud-controlled microgrids energy democracy, providing resilient power and empowering people.
Low-income folks have no voice. They don't have any say in the source of their energy, the location of substations, how it's distributed, how it's priced, what the tariffs are.
Because Dayton's cloud-based microgrid doesn't rely on wires, it can link buildings miles apart, giving communities the ability to create their own virtual power plants.
And as more and more buildings join, my power plant gets bigger and bigger, right? So you have 100 kilowatts over here for Chelsea City Hall, say, 100 kilowatts over there for police department, 100 kilowatts at an apartment. Now you're up into the megawatt range. You're talking about serious power.
The microgrid can also provide a service to the regional electric grid. To prepare for times of peak demand, the New England grid has nearly twice the generating capacity that's typically used. Maintaining that reserve is inefficient, the power expensive, and generating it produces a lot of climate-disrupting emissions. Dayton says that's when his microgrids will prove their worth.
It can therefore remove the whole load of those buildings from the grid instantly, which is worth a huge amount to grid managers. So that's what pays for it. And then the value, of course, to the user is the resilience.
Massachusetts state and regional governmental agencies will pay the $1 million needed to construct phase one of Chelsea's microgrid. Dave Dayton expects the project will pay for itself in a decade. And Chelsea isn't the only community interested in this plan.
Who doesn't want greater protection from power outages? Who doesn't want the potential for energy savings?
Lydia Lowe does. She wants to build a microgrid in Boston's Chinatown. It's an environmental justice community threatened by climate change, flooding, and air pollution from nearby Interstate 93 and the Mass Pike. Lowe is executive director of the Chinatown Community Land Trust. It recently incorporated a public benefit company called Chinatown Power to build a microgrid based on Dave Dayton's technical and economic feasibility study.
I don't know if people thought we were for real, you know, or if it was just a dream that we were pursuing, but we did get cooperation from a number of these building owners to participate, to provide data so that we could really study what it would take. And we're now at the point that we're ready to start something.
Chinatown is increasingly becoming gentrified, preserving affordable housing for longtime residents and protecting people from climate change are top priorities for Lydia Lowe. Her office is just down the block from Oak Terrace, where a third of the 88 units are market rate, the rest low and moderate income.
This is one of two buildings that we've confirmed so far for our phase one microgrid. And we're currently working on a couple of other buildings. And because Chinatown is so dense, a dozen buildings, you're talking about, you know, thousands of people.
And a lot of climate-resilient megawatts stored in an urban microgrid. Chinatown has just started accepting construction bids, and Chelsea has already hired an energy service company to manage phase one of its project.
I spend all my time now on these microgrids.
Engineer Dave Dayton of Resilient Urban Neighborhoods says the electric utility Eversource still has to agree to the projects, but he has big plans for Chelsea's microgrid and beyond.
The city manager wants a citywide microgrid, and then we're going to tie it into universal broadband access so that we have not only resilient power, but resilient internet for low-income people at affordable prices.
Several other Massachusetts communities are also interested in Dayton's design. For cloud-controlled microgrids, the sky really could be the limit. For Here and Now, I'm Bruce Kellerman.
And in case you missed it, on Christmas morning, NASA launched the world's biggest and most powerful telescope yet off the coast of South America.
And we have engine start. And liftoff. Decollage, liftoff from a tropical rainforest to the edge of time itself. James Webb begins a voyage back to the birth of the universe.
The James Webb Telescope is now 2 days into a month-long journey 1 million miles out into space. The telescope is named after the former NASA Administrator James Webb, who led the agency through the first manned U.S. space flights in the early 1960s. The Mercury and Gemini missions weren't as well known as the Apollo missions, but Webb's leadership paved the way for the first steps on the moon. And now, if everything goes according to plan, the telescope with his name on it will take photos capturing the dawn of the universe. Here's current NASA Administrator Bill Nelson.
It's going to take us back to the very beginnings of the universe. We are going to discover incredible things that we never imagined.
Over the next month, as it travels deeper into space, scientists will be conducting remote tests on things like solar panels and antennae to make sure the telescope is working properly. And if it is, NASA says pictures from the $10 billion device could be as groundbreaking as Apollo. Let's take a few minutes now to remember Desmond Tutu, who died yesterday in Cape Town, South Africa. He was 90 years old. Tutu was an Anglican archbishop and the winner of a Nobel Peace Prize for his tireless campaign against apartheid in South Africa. After Nelson Mandela became president, he called on Tutu to head the country's Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which investigated apartheid-era crimes. NPR's Ophibia Quist-Arkton has this remembrance of Archbishop Tutu's life.
President, these were South Africa's first democratic elections, and Tutu was voting for the first time at the age of 62.
I want to sing, I want to cry, I want to laugh, everything together, and jump and dance. And we just want to say to our friends out there, you've been fantastic in supporting us. And the day has arrived. Yuppie!
It had been a long journey for Tutu and Mandela, who spent his first night of freedom after 27 years in jail at then Anglican Archbishop Tutu's residence in Cape Town. For Desmond Impilo Tutu, the son of a high school principal, the church was not his initial vocation. He too started off as a teacher. But the champion of justice felt that the inferior education the white minority rulers were imposing on black South Africans was an insult. Tutu turned to the priesthood and was ordained in 1960. 15 years later, he was the first black dean of Johannesburg and committed himself publicly to the fight against apartheid.
We are going to be free! All of us!
The campaigning priest was arrested more than once, but drew strength, he said, from his faith, his convictions, and fellow South Africans. He condemned all forms of violence and confronted both the apartheid police and vengeful black mobs necklacing alleged spies by throwing tires around their victims and setting them alight. By now, firmly on the international radar, Tutu warned the apartheid leaders that racism defied the will of God and that apartheid would not succeed.
The system of this country, apartheid, is immoral. The system of this country is evil.
But Desmond Tutu allowed himself this cry from the heart.
What must we say, which we have not yet said? What must we do, which we have not yet done, to tell the world that all we want is a new South Africa where all black and white will be able to live as equals?
In 1984, Tutu was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize, recognizing his work in the anti-apartheid struggle. The Archbishop remarked, with his characteristic humor, that one day no one was listening to him, and suddenly, after the prize, anything he said, quotes, "the oracle has spoken." After Nelson Mandela was sworn in as president, he asked Desmond Tutu to chair South Africa's grueling Truth and Reconciliation Commission to look into the crimes of apartheid. For the Archbishop, the harrowing testimony was traumatic, and he broke down and wept with the survivors.
One has been deeply humbled by those we have often called the ordinary people. Deeply humbled at their resilience, at the magnanimity of spirit that they have shown.
Halfway through the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which had to fend off criticism from all sides, Desmond Tutu was diagnosed with prostate cancer in 1997 and received treatment. Resilience and his sense of humor helped. Tutu was later a visiting professor in Georgia. He disclosed a recurrence of prostate cancer in 2005, though it did not have a noticeable effect on his hectic schedule. After he retired, the emeritus archbishop criticized what he considered the inadequacies of South Africa's new leaders, especially their failure to alleviate poverty. He also continued his quest for global peace and social justice, joining the Elders, a seasoned group of world leaders, along with Nelson Mandela, Jimmy Carter, Kofi Annan, and others. Even during difficult times, Tutu said overwhelmingly, faith remained his companion, and he simply operated on the principles of the scriptures.
My freedom is God-given.
Nelson Mandela described the Archbishop as a blessing and an inspiration. Desmond Tutu married his wife, Lia Nomalizo, in 1955. They had four children. Ofebia Quistarkton, NPR News.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix. In the final days of 2021, it's Here and Now.